Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, composer John Adams tells us about the remarkable hidden life of screen goddess Hedy Lamarr.
He met Hedy Lamarr and they collaborated on a torpedo guidance system.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Liesl Schillinger is here to talk about P.D. James's new Jane Austen-based mystery novel.
It feels like Austen a lot of the time. Now, it is a mystery, so it's just P.D. James doing what she does best.
And Gregory Coles has bestseller news. Hedy Lamarr is remembered today as one of the most beautiful movie goddesses of the golden age of cinema. She also had another most remarkable life. It's the subject of a new book. It's called Hedy's Folly, The Life and Breakthrough Inventions of Hedy Lamarr, the Most Beautiful Woman in the World. It's by Richard Rhodes and reviewed for us by the very distinguished Pulitzer Prize winning composer and now favorite critic of ours, the great John Adams, who joins us by telephone from Berkeley. Hi, John.
Hi, Sam.
So this is a story that's really perfect for you because it involves not only Hedy Lamarr, but another remarkable person.
Yes, it involves a really unusual, astonishing collaboration between George Antheil, who was an avant-garde American composer who spent his formative years in Paris. He actually lived upstairs in Sylvia Beach's bookstore, Shakespeare and Company, and, you know, hung out with Ezra Pound and Salvador Dali, and then ended up composing film scores for Cecil B. DeMille's in Hollywood. And in the course of living there, he met Hedy Lamarr, and they collaborated on a torpedo guidance system.
So this was World War II?
They met in the early 40s, and it was actually before America went officially into war, but she was had come to Hollywood from Vienna, and she had read, of course, about Nazi U-boats destroying passenger ships in the Atlantic, and she wanted to do something to contribute to the war effort besides sell bonds.
And what were her talents in this direction? We know what the other ones were. The very famous film where she swam nude and made her an international celebrity. But did she really have the mind and imagination of an engineer?
Well, you see, you're asking the same question that the dubious U.S. Navy and lots of other people ask, which is, you know, how could somebody that beautiful have brains? And, of course, that was one of the obstacles of her life. She appears to have been an astonishingly intelligent person. I personally don't think she was a great movie actress. She's very beautiful, and her facial features particularly were what caught people's attention. But she had a part of her house in Beverly Hills sequestered off, where she had a drafting table, and she liked to invent things.
And what was her background? In some ways, she was really born to a higher caste and certainly someone who would have had more likely an impressive career laid out in front of her than Antheil did.
Well, she was born in Vienna, and she was part of the affluent society. Her father was a very wealthy Jewish Viennese banker, and she had a proper education, went to a private girls' school. But at the age of 18, she decided she didn't want to go to school anymore, and she wanted to act. And so within another year, she was acting, directed by the great Max Reinhardt, and started appearing in movies. And as you mentioned, her first great breakthrough was a film called Ecstasy, in which she appeared very briefly and very tastefully in the nude. But, of course, this was 19, the late 1930s, and it created a huge scandal.
And, John, you mentioned that she was not necessarily a great actress. She was really more almost of a kind of professional beauty in that older mode, right? Someone who was just extraordinary to look at.
She was. I think, you know, you can go on YouTube and you can look at little snatches. I think the archetypal Hedy Lamarr scene is from a movie called Ziegfeld Girls, where I think she was in that movie with Lana Turner and Judy Garland. And, you know, there's hardly acting going on. She's just being this astonishingly beautiful object at that point. I mean, she did appear in some movies in which she had some kind of dramatic, mostly comedy. I think she was best at a sort of acerbic, wry comedy. But, you know, she wasn't the kind of breakthrough artist that someone like Betty Davis was, for example.
And how did she meet Antheil?
Well, actually, Antheil had been writing for Esquire magazine, and he fancied himself an expert on glands. Hedy Lamarr, if you can believe it, the world's most beautiful woman, one of the great money makers for Hollywood, was concerned about the size of her breasts. And she had heard that this composer guy that was living in Hollywood was an expert on glands, so she arranged a dinner at the home of another movie star and asked him whether he could help with her breast size.
And they discovered this common interest in invention?
Well, I don't think anything happened with the anatomical issues, but they got together and started talking. They actually became very, very good friends. There was no romantic involvement, probably much to Antheil's disappointment, but she very much liked him, and over a period of 2 years, they worked very, very hard on this torpedo guidance system, which in a way was a forerunner of what today we call smart bombs.
So it really was a consequential invention they made. This isn't a novelty, really. This is serious weaponry at the time of highly mechanized, militarized warfare.
It was, and what was remarkable about it was that they were able to get a patent for it, and Antheil used his knowledge of player piano mechanisms to to reduce it down to a microchip size. The sad thing, and I think probably why Richard Rhodes calls this Hedy's folly, is that the Navy never took it seriously because, you know, they heard that this was something invented by a composer and a movie star, and how could anything like that be a serious invention? It wasn't until almost 20 years later that other engineers saw this patent and realized that it was, you know, heading in the direction of enormous value and use.
How much of an effort did Hedy Lamarr and Antheil make to persuade the Navy or the armed forces that their invention really was important?
She was, of course, a very serious businesswoman, and she hired the number one patent attorney in Los Angeles, and they worked very hard to lobby the Pentagon, I guess what was the Pentagon in those days. They did receive a patent for this, but you know, the Navy was actually sort of behind. I mean, we know that from how unprepared we were when the Japanese attacked, and they felt that other munition systems were more important at the time, and I think it wasn't until later in the war that they realized how important something like this was.
And what about the later years of Antheil and Hedy Lamarr? You know, their great period passed, and what were their later lives like? Does Richard Rhodes trace that at all?
He alludes to it, but he doesn't go into it deeply. Hedy Lamarr's later years were somewhat unfortunate. You know, she did not have a particularly successful later period as an actress. She was arrested for shoplifting. She spent a great deal of her time suing people, including Mel Brooks. You know, that's very much a case of Hollywood, particularly female movie stars at that time. And Antheil, you know, he was not really one of the great composers. He was of the generation of George Gershwin and Aaron Copland, but he never quite developed his language to become a significant composer. And he died, in the 1950s.
Well, John Adams, it's always a delight to talk to you, and keep writing for us.
Oh, thanks very much, Sam.
Thanks so much. That's John Adams, who this week reviews Hedy's Folly, The Life and Breakthrough Inventions of Hedy Lamarr, the Most Beautiful Woman in the World, by Richard Rhodes. It's on the cover of the book review.
Stepped out of a cloud, I want to take you away, away from the crowd.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So Amazon and the Kindle not getting the best press these days?
Not the best this week. There's been a little bit of an ebook, e-reader, Amazon backlash. There are a lot of reports that the Kindle Fire, Amazon's newest e-reader, which is the very snazzy color tablet for $200, is getting some complaints from people who have bought it that it's too heavy, it's too clunky, it's too sluggish. And Amazon this week has released something resembling a number. They've said that they've sold more than 1 million Kindles each week for the last 3 weeks. This is unusual for Amazon. They usually don't like to release any numbers. They'll say things like, we've sold four times as many Kindles as we sold last year, which of course tells you nothing.
And Julie, at the same time, you reported this week about some good news from what we now call brick and mortar bookstores.
Yes, we have to specify that they are made of bricks and mortar instead of
electronic bites or something
virtually. We have gotten some early reports that things are looking pretty well for brick and mortar bookstores this year. Now, of course, the big news of 2011 was the downfall of Borders, that the chain, which at last count had about 400 bookstores, went out of business this summer and liquidated everything, sold off all of its books and its shelves and everything inside those stores. And some of that business, it looks like, has gone to the other bookstores that are still standing, to Barnes & Noble, which said that over Thanksgiving weekend, they had an increase in 11% in comparable store sales from the year before. And also independents. The American Booksellers Association, which is the trade group for independents, said that they had a jump of about 16% during the week that includes Thanksgiving. That's over the same week in 2010. So this is early. We don't know how things are going to shake out for the whole holiday season. But every bookstore owner I talked to across the country, and that was 15, 20 or more of them, all said that they had really good sales, that they were up over last year, that they weren't quite sure what was happening, but that they were happy that people were coming in and buying the Steve Jobs biography, the Bob Massey book on Catherine the Great, memoirs by Diane Keaton, some non-historian histories by Glenn Beck, Chris Matthews, Bill O'Reilly, who are all in the top five on our list 1 week. So, of course, there are always external forces driving these sales, but some booksellers said that they thought maybe it was just a really strong year for nonfiction and that was really bringing people into bookstores.
Julie, one last question. You had a terrific story on page one of the newspaper about the resurgence in beautiful bookmaking, these exquisite-looking books that are really kind of works of craft. Can it be that that ancient platform, the hardcover book, is actually making a small comeback now?
It could be. I mean, I think that the more exposure people have to ebooks, the more they realize that they only want to read ebooks for a certain type of reading. This is something that I hear over and over again, that other people have reported, that ebooks are really great for convenience reading. If you're traveling, if you're home and you don't really feel like going to the bookstore or ordering something from Amazon, if you're not near a bookstore, for a novel that you want to read and then you don't care if it's on your bookshelf. But then there's also the kind of reading that you want to last, that maybe if you're buying that gorgeous art book, or if you're buying that wonderful Catherine the Great biography, you want it on your bookshelf and maybe you want to lend it to someone else. You don't want it to just disappear after you're finished reading it. So, you know, you do see a lot of publishers now who are taking that into account and thinking that as the ebook market develops, that maybe the people who buy print books are buying them because they want to keep them and they want them to be gorgeous.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
P.D. James, at the amazing age of 91, is still at it. The brilliant British novelist who does crime and mystery, but with a real literary flair, has a new book called Death Comes to Pemberley, and it's reviewed for us by none other than the famous Liesl Schillinger, who's here to talk about it. Hi, Liesl.
Hello, Sam.
So what's she up to in the new novel? This is kind of a Jane Austen takeoff or inflected by Jane Austen somehow.
Oh, well, what this really is a Jane Austen sequel. And I've read a lot of those because, as you may or may not know, it's the 200th anniversary of the first publication of a book by Jane Austen, Sense and Sensibility. Mm. And so there's just so much Jane Austen out there. And I've read a lot of them. But P.D. James is not seeming to be dressing up in Austen. It feels like Austen a lot of the time. Now, it is a mystery, so it's just P.D. James doing what she does best. But she has imported all of the characters of Pride and Prejudice. So that's, remember, Darcy.
Mr. Darcy,
he of the wet shirt diving in the pool at Pemberley. For many of us, this is, of course, Colin Firth comes to mind. But, so Mr. Darcy and Lizzie have been married for 6 years, and they're preparing for the annual Pemberley Autumn Ball. And just as they're sort of polishing the silver and whipping up the mulled wine, in comes a hack chaise rattling up to the door, and out comes her hapless younger sister Lydia screaming.
Because Lydia is the one who ran away from home, right, with the guy in the army or something?
She ran away. She's a very naughty, self-involved twit, basically, who at 15 fell in love with a man named Wickham, Captain Wickham, who is a very badly behaved devil, but very handsome. And Lizzie had once been in love with Wickham, and Wickham was tricked by Darcy, who was in love with Elizabeth. I mean, this is all Pride and Prejudice,
yes,
back
absolutely.
History. But, of course, P.D. James knows we'll all want to be refreshed and brought up to date. So, so Wickham has married Lydia to save her honor after he'd run off with her. But that's something that that Darcy had arranged. So anyway, Darcy has not let Wickham darken the door of Pemberley since that marriage happened. But he and Elizabeth have been married for 6 years, and they're very happy. And in comes the unwelcome Lydia, and someone has been murdered. We don't know whether it's her husband, Wickham, or his friend Captain Denny, who also appeared as a person that Lydia liked to dance with in Pride and Prejudice. So there's been a murder, so they're going to have to cancel the party. And that's sort of how we begin the novel.
Oh, that sounds like so much fun. Is it really good?
This is a Christmas present to the world. I mean, that is too much to say, I know, but it's just true. There are sentences when you're reading this, when you really think you're reading Jane Austen, you know, and P.D. James begins the book by bringing us up to date for where are they now, where the characters have been. And, you know, we find out that Bingley, who is Darcy's and Lizzie's friend, and Jane, Lizzie's sister, who's married to Bingley.
That's the beautiful older sister.
The beautiful older sister who was so ladylike and demure and shy. They have taken a mansion near Pemberley and gotten away from Longbourn, where horrible Mrs. Bennet is still wittering away. Jane and her sister and Darcy and Bingley live nearby. You know, the whole cast of characters is reintroduced to us, and the real dilemma becomes finding out who has caused the murder that has happened, and to find the nefarious underhanded dealings that have brought it all into being. One of the things I remark on in my review is that this writing often really does sound like Jane Austen's writing, and I just want...
Are you going to give us an example?
I want to give you just...
Oh, what a great idea.
No, I'm just giving you the first sentence, just so you can see how much this feels like the opening to Pride and Prejudice. It begins... It was generally agreed by the female residents of Meryton that Mr. and Mrs. Bennet of Longbourn had been fortunate in the disposal and marriage of four of their five daughters. See, that just really does sound like Austen. And later, as this book proceeds, P.D. James tucks in wonderful little things like the fact that all of the neighbors were jealous of Elizabeth and thought that she was sardonic and hoped that she would be unhappy with Darcy. But then they grudgingly befriended her because she gave such good parties, and they all wanted to be invited to Pemberley. There's a sentence where all of the women who disliked Lizzie when she was lowborn have ended up coming to woe, the snobby sisters of Bingley, for example. And they can hardly bear to visit Pemberley just because they can't stand to see her mistress of it. So the psychology is Austen, but the thing that I like so much about P.D. James, and she's written lots of books, you know, about 20. She's very famous for her poet policeman, Adam Dalgliesh. And
which was also a PBS program,
that's
British.
We've seen them on TV. But so it's a highly literate investigator who's always investigating murders. More recently, though, she did a non-Dalgliesh mystery called The Children of Men. Well, she did that in 1992, but it was made into a movie with Clive Owen and Juliet Moore in 2006. There's just beautiful psychological writing in it. But what I thought when I was reading that book is that there's a way in which P.D. James is like Austen, and that way is that they both have this stealth brilliance. They do not ever seem to be showing off. They are aware of envy preemption, how not to make them think that they're too sold on themselves. And so there's this unassuming, effortless cleverness that's in James's writing, which reminds me of Austen's.
Now, Lisa, talk a little bit about P.D. James herself. She's 91. She's very celebrated in England, even a kind of peer of the realm or something.
Yes, she's a conservative life peer. She's 91 years old. She was made a baroness, Baroness James of Holland Park, in 1991 when she was 71. And but, you know, she came from, I wouldn't call it hard scrabble, but from humble beginnings. She quit school at 16, and her father didn't believe in higher education for women. And she married a doctor who got wounded in World War II and soon died. And she went to work. She worked for 30 years in the National Health Service, and then she worked for the Home Office in sort of criminal investigation. She was a board of governors of the BBC. So she worked in British bureaucracies, and those bureaucracies do figure in her mystery novels. She really understands how institutions work.
Thanks so much, Liesl.
Thank you.
That's Liesl Schillinger, who reviews Death Comes to Pemberley in this week's book review. Gregory Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, there's just two books. They're both on the fiction side. The first one is Patricia Cornwell's Red Mist. That is the 19th book in her Case Scarpetta series of Medical Examiner mysteries.
And is that number one?
No, that's new at number two. And then new at number four this week is P.D. James with Death Comes to Pemberley. That is her kind of sequel to Pride and Prejudice that Liesl Schillinger reviewed for us.
And talked about on the podcast.
That's right.
Greg, it's become kind of a staple in the bestseller list column for the columnist, first Roy Garner, then Jenny Schuessler, now you, to approach some well-known authors and ask them what books, if any, they may be giving this season as holiday gifts. Did you investigate, and what did you find?
I did. In fact, Janet Ivanovich is giving some best-selling books herself. She's going to give her husband the Walter Isaacson's Steve Jobs biography, which is at number one this week. Janet Ivanovich is at number six this week with her new novel, Explosive 18. She's also giving Molto Batali, the Mario Batali cookbook, to her son-in-law, and How the Grinch Stole Christmas to her grandson. We had Jodi Picoult, who's going to give her husband a first edition of Beatrix Potter, the Tale of Timmy Tiptoes. Her husband is named Tim, so I guess that's where that comes in.
First edition, that's no joke. That probably set her back a little bit.
I think Jodi Picoult can afford it, Sam. Stephen King is giving his three grandsons an omnibus edition of the DC Comics, The New 52, which is, it takes the DC Comics universe, that's Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman, all of the DC comics, and has copies of the first volume of all of their series, all put together into one volume.
And is that something available in stores, or is this
it is,
something?
It's an expensive book. It lists for $150. I think on Amazon it's marked down to like $90, but you know it's not a cheap present.
But I suppose Stephen King can afford it too.
That's right.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.